You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 21st of January 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello from Studio One here in London and welcome to Midori House. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's programme.
At the moment, it certainly is a very positive thing for the people who are trying to raise awareness of gay rights issues in Africa.
From Kenya and Cairo to Paris and Davos, we'll review the day's top stories with James Boyes and James Schneider right here in the studio. Then we meet the author of Blockbusters, Why Big Hits and Big Risks Are the Future of the Entertainment Business.
There are 8 million tracks released in the US that sold at least one copy. That sounds like a lot, a lot of diversity in the marketplace. But you're right, a third of those 8 million titles that sold at least one copy sold exactly one copy.
And later in the show, we're in Houston to see how the Texan city plans to go green.
We've got a whole new bus route system that's being changed to accommodate our new riders. We've got a new bike share program that we launched that allows people to pick up a bike and take it to another kiosk, and that's exploded over the last year.
All that and more, and maybe even some music as well, right here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, starting right now. So lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House. But before all that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news headlines for around the world.
A report by three former war crimes prosecutors says there's clear evidence that the Syrian regime has systematically tortured and executed around 11,000 people detained since the uprising began nearly 3 years ago. Meanwhile, Syria's Western-backed opposition, the National Coalition, has confirmed it will now take part in international talks in Geneva tomorrow, Wednesday. Anas Abdar is a senior member of the SNC.
The National Coalition welcomes the decision of the Secretary General of the United Nations in withdrawing the invitation that was sent to Iran because Iran has not satisfied the minimum requirement for this invitation. And we thank the Secretary General for also accepting the letter that was sent by the head of the National Coalition, Mr. Ahmed Al-Jarba, in this regard.
The SNC said it would demand the removal of what it called the criminal President Bashar al-Assad during a peace conference set to launch in Montreux in Switzerland. Two United Nations Children's Fund chartered flights carrying aid have landed in South Sudan's capital Juba on Tuesday. Carrying 35 tons of emergency medical and hygiene supplies, the planes had arrived from a UNICEF warehouse in Denmark. The United Nations estimates puts the number of people internally displaced in total within South Sudan as close to 500,000. The U.S. Deputy Secretary of State William Burns has met with South Korea's first vice foreign minister in Seoul today to discuss North Korea. Burns said that the US and South Korea were concerned by the prospect of further reckless behavior from Pyongyang.
The United States and our friends here in the Republic of Korea share a lot of concern about the recent behavior of the DPRK leadership and the dangers of further reckless behavior and provocation in the future. As I said, both of us remain committed to a resumption of credible and authentic negotiations aimed at denuclearization.
Supporters of the Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych staged a rival rally in one of the parks in Kiev. They came to express their support for the embattled leader whose resignation is one of the top demands of protests that have gripped the Ukrainian capital since late November. Protests turned violent after the latest rally on Sunday. After a 10-year journey, Europe's Rosetta spacecraft has ended its hibernation when it returned a signal sent out by the ESA European Space Agency's Mission Control. The head of the Mission Operations Department of ESA, Paolo Freire, has today explained that unlike previous comet probes, Rosetta won't just sail by.
Rosetta will, for the first time in history of spaceflight, reach a comet, stay there, fly around it. Very difficult task because the environment of a comet is extremely dynamic. And it will also deposit a small lander on the surface of the comet. Also the first time it's done in the history of spaceflight.
And finally, the outspoken real estate billionaire Donald Trump said today he may seek the Republican presidential nomination for 2016, claiming he wanted to undo President Barack Obama's legacy. Trump had toyed with the idea of running for the 2012 Republican nomination, but pulled out months before the primary, saying he wasn't ready to leave the private sector. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Jonathan Wheatley ending that news bulletin with a piece of fiction. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're right back after this.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦, 这是 Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europa.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, 1806 just turned here in London, 1306 in New York City. Joining me today with their take on the news is James Boyes, Senior Visiting Fellow at King's College London, and James Schneider, Editor of Think Africa Press. James and James, welcome to the programme. We're going to start with the latest news out of Syria, where a rather astonishing report has been released documenting horrific abuse and torture inside prisons run by the government. And of course, this comes right before the start of the so-called Geneva II peace talks, which are being held in Switzerland this week. They're in Montreux today, tomorrow indeed, and then in Geneva themselves on Friday. James Schneider, if we can start with you. This is, we've seen enormous amounts of reports like this and graphic footage over the last 2.5 years. But this report detailing torture and up to 11,000 executions inside Syrian prisons is pretty horrific.
Yeah, and some of the photos that have been released, as you say, are really, really unpleasant. And I think it's the systematic nature of what is alleged to have happened that is really noteworthy and really upsetting to a lot of people. It looks like the Assad regime is systematically removing whoever it has captured. The context is obviously very important, and it probably doesn't change actually the fundamental dynamics of the Geneva discussion, because whilst obviously this is a large kind of moral victory for those who oppose Assad both within Syria and internationally, the basis of the Geneva discussions and the China diplomatic attempts to end this war is the kind of extension of what is going on in the battlefield. And in that case, even though Assad has a case to answer of some sort for war crimes, he's still in a strong enough position on the battlefield that he still has to be, he's still a diplomatic element.
James Boyes, I mean, there is obviously an element of politics here in the fact that this report was commissioned by Qatar, which has been a vocal and very financial backer of the Syrian rebels, and it comes right before the beginning of the talks. How much should we take that into account when considering this report?
Well, I don't think we can discount it. I think that if you look at the data that's being released, as James rightly pointed out, it's horrific. It's distasteful. Most people, I think, would be sickened by what they see in these images. But what it does do, I think, is reinforce a narrative which is coming out, which is very damning of the Assad regime. One of the great problems, of course, though, is that we're dealing with a situation whereby, it lacks an obvious good guy, effectively. The opposition, which I think the West was perhaps in some position to get behind, possibly as long ago as 2 years ago, appears to have fragmented. We look at the opposition forces arraigned against Assad. It's very difficult to say, well, there's a clear-cut moral imperative here. There's no doubt about it that the Assad regime has severe case to answer in terms of potential war crimes, if it will ever get to that point. But again, that raises an obvious question about why Assad would enter into the Geneva II Convention when you consider what the alternative is. If he's driven from power or relinquishes power, I think he knows what awaits him. And it's very difficult to see, therefore, how we're going to get a pleasant result out of the end of all this.
James,
I think that the that it's paid for by Qatar is important. Also, I noticed something a little bit strange is that the lawyers who prepared it are Carter Ruck here in London, who are more famous for super injunctions and libel cases. Remember things like Trafigura and things like that. So there are still some sort of, this is not to sort of write off the evidence that's been presented, but there are definitely questions.
But
this is
not Amnesty International. This is not Human Rights
precisely.
Watch. It's not UN investigators.
Yeah, exactly.
James Schneider, when you look at these peace talks that are beginning to, that we hope are going to start tomorrow, and you look at this situation of how do you actually try to have peace talks with players that really don't want to talk to each other and both have very different goals. I mean, there is no sort of happy solution that anyone can think of which could possibly come out from these two working together. How do you, begin to consider the next steps in these peace talks when you're in this sort of situation?
I think, the other James is right when he says that there's no obvious good guy and there's also no obvious good solution here. And I think the way forward needs to combine very, very, very short-term thinking with very, very long-term thinking. So the long-term has to be how can you significantly reduce the violence so that you get some kind of reduction and some kind of stability of some sort. And then, the short-term thing has to be if you get people to talk tomorrow, if they talk the day after, if they talk the day after that, those are all little victories. These peace talks are not going to come up with a comprehensive peace. Not all of the players that need to be there are there. There is a huge chasm between people, but at least there is some beginning. Well, I know it's the second round, but at least there's some beginning of people talking to each other.
James Boyce, we were talking yesterday on this programme with Daniela Pellet and Michael Jameson about the fact that there was a very, very, very low bar set for these peace talks, which was if they actually happen and people mm-hmm. turn up, they'll be considered a success. I mean, in a sense, James Schneider's right there, isn't he, when he says that actually, so long as they're talking, then that is something.
Yeah, it's difficult. I mean, I think one of the great problems in recent years is that arguably since the coming to power of the Bush administration in 2001, there's been a sense that, oh, we shouldn't talk to our enemies. But of course, we only make peace with our enemies. We don't make peace with our friends. And I think there have been examples where we've seen combative groups coming together. One can think of the Camp David Accords in the 1970s. We could think about the Dayton Accords, for example, that ended the Bosnian situation in the 1990s. There have been examples whereby warring groups have come together, we thought had very little chance of success, and they have proven to be successful in the past. I think the problem at this point is that with the overview of the United States and Russia being so prevailing, the question mark about the participation of Iran, and it's very, very difficult to see how it is that either side in Syria is going to come out of this happy.
Okay, we're going to stay in Switzerland, but we're going to change tack dramatically. In fact, we're switching to a rather small Alpine town, Davos, where the World Economic Forum is meeting once again this year. James Schneider, this year they've been talking about how inequality is a bit of a problem. I mean, in a way, you have to applaud them and say, "Well, welcome
really?
to the real world, guys." We're glad you got here eventually. Now, Davos is, it's often sort of dismissed as a bit of a talking shop, and where the rich and the famous and the powerful go to meet on the top of a mountain. Is there anything else, James Schneider, in it that you think that there's a purpose to?
Yeah, I don't think it is just a talking shop because. Things come out of it. I mean, a lot of the NAFTA negotiations for the free trade agreement between Mexico, the US and Canada, some of that was took place at Davos talks. But I think it's interesting to see what kind of ideas come out of it, because it is really the global elite talking to itself in a very self-confident but also not very self-conscious way. So you can see what kind of ideas are going around. And the inequality thing is interesting but also not new. The WEF holds different regional World Economic Forums, and their Africa ones in recent years have tried to focus on things like equitable growth and youth unemployment and so on, because there's there's a sense of fear, I think, in global elites, and probably rightly so, for world stability if these kind of inequalities continue.
James Boyce, they're self-confident but not self-conscious.
Yeah, it's a great line. I like that. Hats off to you. There's no doubt about it that it's very difficult to feel too much sympathy for this. There's a movie that's just come out in this country, The Wolf of Wall Street, which is getting a lot of criticism for seemingly glorifying self-centered, self-motivating individuals at the very time in which, of course, we've been going through an age of austerity. It's very difficult, I think, to look at what's going on at the World Economic Forum and have too much sympathy with the people who are gathered there.
It's interesting that with The Wolf of Wall Street, that you've had entire cinemas in the US, just near Wall Street, and here near Canary Wharf, where it's been booked out by bankers who are celebrating this guy in the same way that they didn't quite get Gordon Gekko was a bad guy in the 80s, or
film was a satire.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, the irony of this film has been made as a satire, and I think that one of the challenges is that there's too many people who've taken it very, very seriously. And I think if you look at it, if you look at the trailer, look at the material, it's clearly meant to be sending up the situation, but I think there's an awful lot of people out there who are being a little bit too ruffled by it. One of the interesting things coming out of the Davos situation, I understand, is that they're actually offering an ability to almost tour as a transient, someone who's looking for a refugee, almost feel like what it feels like to be a refugee. And apparently Bono signed up for this, I understand.
Well, yes, yeah. I can think of all sorts of things we could get Bono to
absolutely.
Do. They've done those sorts of refugee runs before as a sort of way of sort of, hey, look, here's a snapshot of what life's like, and then they go back to their champagne.
You get it.
There are obviously other things happening at Davos as well, and of course we're going to be checking in with Bloomberg's editors and correspondents throughout the week. The FT is, of course, another one of the big media outlets that's always present at the World Economic Forum. And this is their editor, Lionel Barber, who's looking into his crystal ball for the year's big political events.
Middle East, it's a mess. Very concerned about Egypt. Very concerned, obviously, about the Syria, what's happening there with the effect on the region, neighbouring countries, Jordan, great instability there, Lebanon, great instability, and countries which you wouldn't normally in the recent past, have associated with instability, economic, financial and political instability, like Turkey. So the only brighter spot, and I speak with guarded words here, is Iran. And President Rouhani, I understand, will be attending the conference. And as we know, late last year, there was an interim deal to contain Iran's nuclear program. If there could be a broader agreement, bringing in the Americans, that would be a big positive signal for the region.
That was Lionel Barber, editor of the Financial Times there, and he was just talking about some of the big political themes from Iran to Egypt to Syria. And James Schneider, of course, that is the other thing that's going to be happening at Davos, is that you've got all these world leaders turning up. They're all going to be there, lots of foreign ministers as well. And there will be a lot of little chats on the sideline about some of these big events.
Yes, there will be. But I think probably the more important little chats on the sideline will be between governments and corporate partners trying to set up particular projects that they feel that both they, as in the corporate leader and the political leader, can benefit from. The problem with the little political chats on the side is we don't always know that they're taking place or how they are unless they're successful and they come out later. But I think that Davos is, it's political in the sense that it's about discussing how the world should be run and should be organised. But I think it should more be seen in a kind of economic context.
Yeah, I thought what was quite interesting about that report there was the suggestion that the Americans should get more involved in the region. I think America's got an awful lot of involvement in that region. I know John Kerry is desperately running around trying to get his Nobel Peace Prize. And the great problem you've got is the fact that the American electoral system is going to start kicking into high gear very soon, which is going to turn all of America's attention away from the international to the domestic. We've got the midterms coming up at the end of this year. And I hate to say this, but 3 years today, the next American president will have spent his first full day on the job. So Obama's time dragging down as we speak.
We're not going to even think about that yet. You're listening to Midori House. In a moment, we're going to be turning our attention to Africa. I'm with James Schneider and James Boyes. We're back in a moment.
The entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages, and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious, and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's in Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So, if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet. Monocle has shops around the world selling our exclusive collaborations with some of our favourite designers, including Ettinger, Porter, Barenna, Jawbone, Oliver Peoples, and many more. You can find us on College Street in Toronto, Hudson and Charles in New York, and in the heart of Wan Chai in Hong Kong, and two in London. So, whether you're after a versatile travelling wardrobe, something for the home, or a present for a loved one, or just missing back issues from your collection, you're sure to find something at the Monocle shop.
You're back with us here on Midori House, at indeed Midori House here on Monocle 24. I'm with James Boyes and James Schneider. We're going to talk in a minute about Egypt and then also Kenya. But first, the German newsweekly Der Spiegel has just put out an article on France's burgeoning military might. The headline, France, Europe's sole military force. James Boyes, they're taking the mick, surely, aren't they?
Well, as a proud Brit, one has to take some offence at this. I think what is interesting is where it is that they're talking about the French acting. And there's an awful lot here going on with regard to the French involvement in the Central African Republic and on Africa in general. It seems to me that there's some degree of French imperial overstretch going on here a little bit. It's also important to recognise, I think, that if you look at the countries involved here, clearly Germany has got its own issues with regard to sending troops anywhere, because of its historical role. Britain, of course, is trying to scale back its economic expenditure on the military. It's come under attack from the United States for it to do so. We were talking last week, for example, with regard to Gates' comments about the inability of the United Kingdom to continue to spend to partner the United States. And there's no doubt that France, I think, is some degree of an ascendancy, but I think one must ask whether a lot of this is about trying to divert attention from domestic issues that it may have under President Hollande.
James Schneider, you know, is that fair that that France is just trying to divert attention from problems at home?
No, although that's part of it. I think there's one structural cause at the EU level, which is there's been a failure of coming up with how you would have a common EU foreign policy. So what we've got instead is a kind of division of a kind of impromptu de facto division of labour between different countries.
Because we're supposed to have a rapid reaction force.
We're meant to have a rapid reaction force, and Catherine Ashton is that role is meant to be larger, at least in some people's formulations. And so what you've got is this kind of division of labour where some countries do a bit, and that, so France is kind of operating on behalf of the EU in some places, and Britain and others, and so on. But the problem with this is that whilst it works in some cases, you get a big free rider effect. And I think that's what France in particular is getting rather annoyed about. Also, when so it's, you know, had operations in Libya, in Mali, in the Ivory Coast and in Central African Republic. And in those three sub-Saharan ones, those are former colonies, which is why it's the one that is able to act. And the current French presidency, I think, is aware, at least in part, of how problematic that is. and they're looking for both to broaden out their engagement with African military support, but also broaden out with other European support. And I don't think they're getting that much joy on the latter front, because the EU is meant to be sending troops to the CAR, but it was going to be 1,000. Today it got scaled back to 500.
And it might be Estonians, which, you know, isn't necessarily the strongest fighting force. James Boyes, is there a problem here that because the EU can't get its act together, and actually on this, you know, let's not forget that Britain shares part of it, the responsibility for this, because they've failed to take the lead on defence, despite the fact that it was kind of open for them to do so. That this then becomes countries only taking the lead when it's their former colonies, which then brings all sorts of other problems. So we'll have that with Francophone Africa, with France. And if, God forbid, there was something in Uganda, then it would be the Brits that would be under pressure to send some sort of intervening force.
There's a potential for that. I really can't see David Cameron being in any great hurry to send troops into Uganda, quite honestly. I think one of the problems with this is, you know, Henry Kissinger famously once said, if I want to talk to someone in Europe about foreign policy, who do I speak to? And if the answer at the moment is Cathy Ashton, I think there's still a problem there, because
that's a little bit unfair considering what she's done in terms of Serbia and Kosovo. It's a bit unfair in terms of what she's done on, you know, Iran.
Possibly, but the point I'm trying to make is this, is that you put these structures in place and then you bring in people who've not necessarily got the gravitas to fulfil the role. And one of the challenges you've got, I think, is there's still some degree of question mark about how serious you want to take the idea of having a united leadership across countries of European foreign policy. And as long as you have a risk whereby you don't want individual countries being overpowered by that, I don't think we're going to come up with a straightforward answer anytime soon. I think it's fascinating to see France taking the lead. I mean, we saw a couple of years ago, there was an agreement where we were going to enter into naval operations with the French. It's a great sign. I think it's interesting. I think that, you know, the European countries are starting to take the lead on this, because it does alleviate the pressure on the United States to get involved in every single opportunity when they're clearly not going to.
But Europe still has this problem, and it's a NATO problem as well, really, if you take away the US. That everyone's cutting their budgets, but no one's really talking to each other about, well, you know what, we'll focus on tanks and we'll focus on planes and we'll focus, and obviously it's not quite as simple as that, but there's very little discussion amongst member states about who's going to specialise where, and it's all right because we're all working together.
Yeah, and I think because that's not ultimately in any nation's national interest to do so, because whilst everything seems to be great at the moment, if you start saying, right, fair enough, we will scale back on this area and we'll let you dominate the land armies and you have all the tanks, you suddenly leave yourself wide open to a potential invasion in the future if, heaven forbid, the European project doesn't work out. We're living through a nice peaceful age at the moment, but history reveals that's not necessarily the way of the future.
James Boyes, there still fears a land invasion from the French. We're going to end this half of the programme with a slightly more uplifting story. The brilliant Kenyan author Binyavanga Wainaina has announced that he's gay. He's famous for his strong views on the West's perceptions of Africa. Indeed, he wrote a fantastic piece for Granta a few years ago called How to Write About Africa. In a moment, James Schneider will hear from you about what you think about his announcement, particularly the way he did it. But first, here's Wainaina himself talking to Al Jazeera English last year on the West Africa reporting.
They used to tell us in school that when the missionaries came, they came smiling and hugging and bringing the Bible, and right behind them came the guns and the power. So in a certain sense, I feel like the world of humanitarianism and aid in Africa is designed to keep people passive, dependent, and allow power. So the arrival of this world of embedded aid, of the pity African, of the compassionate African, pity the baby, and all of that, came at the same time as the fall of the IMF, the fall of Russia, and the beginning of opening up the continent, where every government was told, cut down your budgets for university education, right, which is what my generation happened. Let the middle class collapse and open yourselves to European and Western markets. Those two things come together. So that's just the happy face of the same PR machine.
That's Binyavanga Wainaina speaking last year. A little bit earlier, our correspondent Tristan McConnell, who interviewed Binyavanga yesterday about coming out, spoke to us and gave us his view.
Anyone who's interacted with Binyavanga or spent time with him, this isn't, you know, a big surprise. He hasn't gone around Nairobi or New York or Lagos or wherever he's been, you know, hiding his kind of flamboyant nature and all the rest of it. So it wasn't surprising to people who knew him. And when I was speaking to him the day after his short essay was published, in which he came out as being gay, he said he still, you know, he'd only really had positive feedback, but he was kind of expecting a bit of a storm to develop around it. But at this stage, it's a little bit too early to say how it's going to affect his kind of standing, if you like. And at the moment, it certainly is a very positive thing for the people who are trying to raise awareness of gay rights issues in Africa.
Yeah, that was Tristan McCall in Nairobi. James Schneider, just briefly, we're living through a time where, you know, there have been many, many attempts across the continent to make homosexuality illegal, to throw people in jail, even threats to kill gay people from MPs, from government ministers. And Binyavanga Wainaina is now, without doubt, I think, sort of the most famous gay man in Africa. How important do you think that could be?
I think it's really important. It's really important because of who he is. A lot of the homophobic narratives that are coming from certain African governments and homophobic activists try to frame homophobia as being a kind of anti-colonial a struggle, and they try to dress it up in that discourse. And Binyavanga Wainaina can never be called a stooge of the West, a sort of purveyor of an outside political, cultural and economic agenda that he's trying to foist on Kenya. He's a ruthless critic of both Western paternalism, but also the way in which international elites interact with Kenyan elites, and that, you know, damages the Kenyan population. So I think his steps and what he's been saying over, you know, in his essay, but also over social media the last couple of days, is really powerful, and it has the potential to have some really good effect.
James Schneider from Think Africa Press and James Boyes from King's College London, thank you both for joining us here on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Дете е Monocle 24.
Лондонис, Нью Йоркис, Токиос. Се е Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Much, much more still to come here in Midori House. We're going to be in Milan. We're going to learn the business secrets of the entertainment world, discover how Houston, Texas is going green, and review some new tracks from our music man in Tel Aviv. But first, here's Jonathan with the headlines.
Thank you very much. A report by three former war crimes prosecutors says there's clear evidence that the Syrian regime has systematically tortured and executed around 11,000 people detained since the uprising began nearly 3 years ago. Two United Nations Children's Fund chartered flights carrying aid have now landed in South Sudan's capital Juba, carrying 35 tons of emergency medical and hygiene supplies. The planes had arrived from a UNICEF warehouse in Denmark. The UN estimates puts the number of people internally displaced in total within South Sudan as close to 500,000 people. The US Deputy Secretary of State William Burns has met with South Korea's first vice foreign minister in Seoul today to discuss North Korea. Burns said that the US and South Korea were concerned by the prospect of further reckless behaviour from Pyongyang. And supporters of the Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych staged a rival rally in one of the parks in Kiev today. They came to express their support for the embattled leader, whose resignation is one of the top demands of protests that have gripped the Ukraine capital since late November. And that's the latest news for the moment on Monocle 24.
Jonathan, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House live here on Monocle 24. I say live, if you are listening on the download, you do know you can listen live. Oh yes, get your internet radio out. It is 21:34 in Moscow, 19:34 in Milan, 18:34 here in London. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents from around the world, and we're heading to Milan, where Ivan Carvalho is here with the week's top stories. Ivan, welcome to Midori House.
Good evening, Steve.
We're going to be talking about rail and plane a little moment, and also a rather curious diplomatic squabble. But first, the new voting law in Italy. Now, new voting laws can sound a little dull, but this has very, very important ramifications.
Indeed, it does. Matteo Renzi, who's the secretary of the Democratic Party, he met over the weekend with Silvio Berlusconi to hash out a new electoral law, which everyone agrees Italy needs, because the current one, well, first of all, it's been unconstitutional, according to the courts, has always led to problems of getting governability in the system because of the complicated ways in the two houses of government. Candidates, parties have to win the election because of complicated systems that have been set up by Berlusconi, a previous law that Berlusconi had wanted. So Renzi decided to hash out an agreement with Berlusconi. Some people in Renzi's party weren't happy about this meeting with Berlusconi in the Democratic Party headquarters, but Renzi said it's important to get Berlusconi on board to pass this new law. There's been an agreement, and now Renzi has brought it to his party. And the majority agree with it, so it looks like it's going to be going to a vote later on in the coming months, which would be good for Italy.
It's interesting that Matteo Renzi, who is, you know, the coming man in Italy and has been for several years, he's still only 38, he's the mayor of Florence, he's the man who would be prime minister, one would think, if there was an election tomorrow. And yet, here he is doing backroom deals with Silvio Berlusconi. It doesn't quite fit in with the image, does it? That he's sort of portrayed as that he is a sort of the new man doing politics in a new way.
You know, it is true. I mean, the Beppe Grillo's five-star movement has been very intransigent from the beginning, you know, dealing with the established parties. And so Renzi said, look, you know, I'm going to talk to the opposition, and who is the opposition right now? It's Silvio Berlusconi. Even though Berlusconi was ejected from the Senate, he still controls Forza Italia, and so you really can't get anything done by going around him. So he said, look, let's be pragmatic. I'll talk to him. We have an agreement, and this is the best thing for the country right now. And he's trying to get, you know, movement going, because Enrico Letta's government, they're both in the same party, hasn't been doing a lot. And Renzi believes that there needs to be action. There needs to be that the government is seen to be actively doing something, and his party needs to be doing something. So he's very much for getting things done, and he's hoping that will be reflected, you know, down the road in the polls. In the favour of the Democratic Party. We'll have to see about that.
Indeed. Let's look at a diplomatic squabble. This is between Italy and India, and it goes back to 2012 when two Indian fishermen were killed by Italian marines who were supposedly protecting an Italian oil tanker from pirates, except, of course, they weren't pirates, they were fishermen. This is now, they're trying to bring this to court, but there's issues over where they're actually going to be tried.
Yeah, this is very a difficult, delicate case for diplomats. Since the Marines have been arrested and in India, they've actually had a few times been allowed to return to Italy and visit. And there were guarantees, at least in the beginning, from the foreign ministry in India to the Italian government that these two Marines would not face the death penalty. You know, Italy does not have the death penalty, and the government society is very much against the death penalty. And so they were thought to believe that was going to not be one of the sentences. But now the Interior Ministry in India has decided to charge these men under an anti-terrorism law. And so this has now become a row, almost very, very problematic. It's actually gone to the point where Emma Bonino, Foreign Secretary, is talking to her EU colleagues, saying we should apply some pressure on India. There's a meeting coming up very soon with the EU and India about this. And so they're trying to find some agreement. You know, India's been suffering lately. There's that diplomatic row recently with the U.S. and diplomat that was kicked out. And so maybe India is trying to sort of position itself and show a bit of strength. It's hard to say now, but it's definitely a difficult moment for diplomats.
And just finally and briefly, you're in Milan. You often have to go down to Rome. You'd think that it would be relatively easy to get down there. It's only 300 miles. There should be a great high-speed rail. But most people seem to get the plane until recently, don't they?
Yes, one of the most lucrative air routes up until recent times has been the Milan-Rome shuttle. That's something that let Alitalia sort of survive for many years. Ryanair, some of these low-cost competitors, came into the market. But just recently, Ryanair said they're going to give up flying from an airport just outside Milan to Rome because, you know, there's now two services, the state-run operator and a private rail operator that's backed by Diego della Valle of Todd's and Montezemolo of Ferrari. And so you have lots of choice, many, many trains every hour, half hour, direct trains, 3 hours, your city center. And rail has become very much vogue in Italy now, and it's showing that, at least in terms of, you know, national rail service, it's very, very good, and something that Alitalia is going to have problems in the near future about restructuring because they've lost a very lucrative route. But I think rail is good in this case.
Rail is good. Yes, I think we can all pretty much agree on that. Ivan Carvalho, Monocle's Milan correspondent. Thank you very much indeed. Still to come, we're going to be in Houston. We're going to be in Tel Aviv. And we're also going to be talking about the big business of entertainment. That's all to come here on Midori House.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. And now, according to a new book by entertainment industry expert Anita Elbersay, the future of popular culture will revolve around so-called blockbusters, with blockbusters bigger is better and also the safer strategy for the product to sell well. In the book, Blockbusters, Why Big Hits and Big Risks Are the Future of the Entertainment Business, Anita studied cases from Hollywood to pop music and sport. She came to the conclusion that blockbusters are the surest way to achieve success.
They live by what I call a blockbuster strategy, which means that of all the money they have to spend, they spend a disproportionate amount of their production and marketing budget on what they see as the most likely winners. So a film studio might be releasing 25 products in a given year, but they spend hundreds of millions of dollars on the 3 to 5 films that they think are really going to make it do well at the box office. And it seems very risky, but the idea is that that's actually the safest way to go. What would be more risky is to spend that same money on a larger number of smaller products. It's really, really hard to compete with those small products.
Why do you think is that? Do you think it's because sometimes people, they want to see the same film? Is it kind of a shared social thing? Do you think that might be?
Sure, yes. I think that is one of the reasons. One of the reasons is that it fits the way in which consumers are making choices. We do have a taste for popular products. But there are other reasons too. Another reason is that we love products that are costly, right? That have high production values, and I think with good reason, because you can tell the difference if you're looking at a movie that has very high quality special effects. You can tell the difference with a movie that was trying to save cost on that. And I think you see those same phenomena in a wide range of different entertainment products, where spending more actually makes the products better. Another reason is that there are marketing advantages. If you increase the budget for a film or a book with 100%, you don't necessarily have to increase the marketing budget with 100%. It's much more efficient to advertise something on a national scale and go all in. So there's several reasons why this works. And another reason, which I describe in detail in my book, is that it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's a bit of a fake reason that these things work. Just by spending a lot of money and devoting all your resources to it, you get other people to join in, and they want to help promote this, and they feel that this is something big, so they're going to be talking about it. The media will write about it. Radio stations will want to have people who are involved in this in their shows. So it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, and the big spenders actually end up making most money in the marketplace.
At the same time, do you think it's more dangerous if there is a flop? For example, you do mention in your book the film John Carter from Disney, which was a big flop. I think cost like $250 million.
Our world is dying. Fate has brought you here, John Carter.
A man holds the key.
You may be the only one who can save us.
Do you think it's more dangerous as well for the company to recover from a flop like this because they invested so much money in it?
Well, there could be huge failures, and that's of course extremely painful. But the companies that make these bets in general have the scale to support it. They're not going to go and make a bet that they can't survive if it's not bringing in any money. So I think in my study of the entertainment industry, they tend to be relatively careful. And again, they would be taking more risks if they were to spend this amount of money on a larger number of smaller projects. So we really have to worry about studios that say, instead of making the $250 million movie, we're making 10, $25 million movies. That would be a disastrous strategy.
And moving on, I mean, you talk about several parts of the entertainment industry. Let's talk about music. You mentioned the artist Lady Gaga and the Born This Way campaign, which was like a blockbuster. Can you tell us the strategy for the campaign for this album?
My mama told me when I was young, we're all on superstars. She rolled my hair, put my lipstick on, in a glass of her boudoir.
Sure, absolutely. So what I think is really interesting with Lady Gaga is how fast she came to be a superstar. A year before, everyone knew her on this planet. Or almost everyone knew her on this planet. She was a supporting act for New Kids on the Block, right? So she was she climbed really, really fast. And initially, the way her first album was launched was using what I call a grassroots approach, which is market by market, investing just as much as you can afford, and trying to make sure that consumers pay attention to the album, and lots of different groups have a chance to hear the album. But once she was big, it's actually much, much better and less risky to have a big blockbuster campaign, not a grassroots release, but go all in, get lots of partners to make sure that they support the launch, make sure that it's in everyone's hands easily. So go for big distribution and big marketing. And that was highly successful for the Born This Way launch, which was not her first album, but actually her third album.
And I was very surprised, I mean, still talking about music, I read in your book that apparently in 2011, 32% of the songs, there's only one copy sold on iTunes, for example. That's very surprising. So maybe that's why companies should focus on the blockbusters, because some songs, they don't sell anything.
Exactly. Most people think that with the rise of online channels and where it's easier for everyone to create songs and upload them, most people think that will lead to a very different media landscape. But yeah, the statistic that you mentioned is something that I report in the book. In 2011, there were 8 million tracks released in the U.S. that sold at least one copy. That sounds like a lot of diversity in the marketplace. But you're right, a third of those 8 million titles that sold at least one copy sold exactly one copy. Now, that's your mom buying a song out of pity because you've released it, right?
Or yourself.
And then you're done for the year. Or yourself, yeah, to test to see if it works. So that's pretty dire. And it's actually 94% of all products released in that year sold fewer than 100 copies.
I only hope for her sake that she wasn't the only person who bought blockbusters. Why big hits and big risks are the future of the entertainment business. I'm sure she wasn't. That was Anita Elbasay, and she was talking to Fernando Augusto Pacheco. We're off to Houston now. It is, what time is it there? Oh, it's 12:48, just turned. Lunchtime there. It's just hours before Monocle's subscribers party there in Houston. If you're in Houston and you're not a subscriber, you're missing out. Our Toronto Bureau Chief, Nelly Gotcheva, stopped by the City Hall to chat with Laura Spanion. She's the Director of the Office of Sustainability in Houston. And Nelly asked about the city's Green Houston programme and its big push to become a cleaner, and more environmentally friendly city.
Houston, I think in many people's eyes, is really the oil and gas capital, you know, of the United States, if not the world, right? And hasn't always had the best air quality, there's times in the past where, you know, the environmental issues haven't been at the forefront. But what's great about now is that more and more sustainability, quality of life, healthy environment, healthy lifestyle are more and more becoming things that people want. They also, you know, they still want jobs in the oil and gas sector, but they also want a high quality of life. And that's where I come in, because I do things that improve our air quality, water quality, provide transportation options. We launched a great bike share program, you know, just last year. And so there's so many things we're doing to try to create a healthier Houston for folks to not just work here, but live here and raise their families.
Can you tell me something like more about your latest initiatives and how do you work towards like making life better here and healthier here? And you just mentioned this new bike initiative. Also, last year was the year of the bike in Houston. So if you can tell me more about this and how do you help people live better in Houston?
So one of the things Houston's also known for besides oil and gas is that we're a sprawling city. You know, we're 600 and something square miles. A lot of people get around by car, right? That creates a lot of emissions. Well, more and more people are wanting to live in the inner part of the city, the inner loop, and they don't want to drive as much to work. They want other transportation options. They want shorter commutes. And so we are providing more and more options for them. So we have three new rail lines that are opening as we speak in 2014. You've probably seen construction down the street. We've got a whole new bus route system that's being changed to accommodate our new riders. We've got a new bike share program that we launched that allows people to pick up a bike and take it to another kiosk. And that's exploded over the last year. And we're looking at other options such as car share. We're improving the walkability of Houston by expanding and growing our sidewalks. And we just passed this amazing initiative that really secured us as the year of the bike. It's called the Bayou Greenway Initiative. And that is a voter-approved initiative that is, over the next few years, we're going to build 100 new miles of hike and bike trails along 11 of our bayous that intersect throughout the city and open up our bayous to more recreational access. So it's going to create what I call a green highway for Houston.
And how clean and healthy is Houston compared to other big cities in Texas and in the rest of the country?
We've so much improved. I mean, we used to be, you know, on all the top 10 lists, I mean, of the worst air quality in the United States. You know, now we're not on those lists anymore. We still have a ways to go to improve our air quality, particularly for fence line communities that are abutting our refineries. So we have a lot more work to do, but our air quality has definitely improved. The refineries are definitely, their practices are much better than they used to be. We're real happy and proud about that. When it comes to big things like energy efficiency, we're a leader in the state, us in Austin. I mean, we've really done a ton to try to make our buildings and our infrastructure more energy efficient. And we are really a leader in the state when it comes to that and our building codes, et cetera. So we're right up there with Austin, who's oftentimes considered, you know, a very progressive liberal city that has a lot of green initiatives. We are right behind them, and I hope soon we'll be able to surpass them when it comes to our green practices.
That was Laura Spangen, Director of the Office of Sustainability in Houston, with our own Nelly Gotcheva. It's Midori House. It's nearly the end of Midori House. It's music review time. We're heading to Tel Aviv, where music producer Nadav Ravid is armed with the tracks that we need to know. Nadav, thank you very much for joining us on Midori House.
My pleasure. Hello.
Hello, indeed. Now, we're going to be going through a few of your tracks that you're listening to at the moment that you want to share with the rest of us. But before we get into the specifics, what's the more general feeling for you at the moment with music?
I don't know. I'm really finding it harder and harder to find a general theme for the music I'm consuming. There's just so much of everything. It's just about picking, you know, the good stuff from all kinds of genres and artists from all over the world. So I don't know. I mean, 2013 was a great year, and I think 2014 is going to be another great year for music.
Now, we're going to go through some of the stuff you're selecting, but it's all sorts of different types of music from all over the world. Where do you find it? How do you sort of tend to find new music? Is it through rooting through record shops? Is it through the stuff that you're sent? Is it recommendations from friends?
It's a combination of everything. It's anything from the social media feed to going to record stores and browsing through the new releases and going through the blogs feed. And some of the stuff is getting sent by record companies. Again, there's so much music and there's so much noise. And the hard part is not to get to the music is to filter the good stuff out.
Indeed. Well, hopefully you're going to do that for us. The first track you're going to play is from Sharon Jones, who is a bit of a Monocle 24 favourite. She was on our playlist right back at the start. Tell us a bit about this track.
This is one of her best tracks ever, perhaps my favorite Sharon Jones track ever. She had a very rough year last year. This album was supposed to come out last year, but then she was diagnosed with cancer and everything was put on hold. All her tours around the world were put on hold. And she's been treated with chemo during 2013. And it looks like she's managed to get it out of her system. And now the album is coming out and there's a tour coming up. And this song is just like a classic, a lost classic Motown track.
Let's hear it then. This is Sharon Jones with Retreat. Sharon Jones, Retreat. Don't worry, we'll put that on the Monocle 24 playlist so you can hear more of it. Now let's talk about Quabs and their new track, Wrong or Right. Nadav, what can you tell us about that?
Well, I got to Quabs through one of the producers who are working with them, a guy called Son, who's an English guy living in Austria, in Vienna. And he's been up and coming in the last year doing some stuff on his own and with the American singer Banks. And then I stumbled on this track he did with Quabs. He produced this track for him. And then I realized Quabs is sort of a big deal, an up-and-coming singer, R&B singer in England, who's going to release his debut album early this year. And this track is a good combination of the electronic production by Son, which brings a lot of edginess into the music.
Let's hear it then. It's Quabs with Wrong or Right. Are you running away? Could my love do you better? Cause there's something that I need to let you know. If you're looking for a place to hide. Quabs there with Wrong or Right. We're going to try and squeeze two more in, Nadav, if we can. Warpaint and Biggie, tell us briefly about that.
Warpaint is a feminine foursome from Los Angeles. They're doing a sort of a shoegazy, dream pop kind of music. The second album is just leaked a couple of weeks ago. It's another great album from them. And I'm actually really looking forward to the documentary, which is going to be released about the making of this album, because it's been made by one of my favorite filmmakers out there, Chris Cunningham, who's done some amazing videos in the past.
He has indeed. Let's hear the track. This is Warpaint with Biggie. Warpaint with Biggie. Nadav, I really want to play the last track. It's Young Fathers and Get Up, but I'm only going to give you 10 words to say something nice about them. Go on.
Great lo-fi Scottish R&B meeting indie music, similar to TV on the Radio.
Perfect. Young Fathers, Get Up. Young Fathers there with Get Up. Nadav Ravid in Tel Aviv, thank you very much indeed for sharing those tracks with us here on Midori House.
Thank you.
And don't worry, we'll put all those tracks on the Monocle 24 playlist and you can listen to them throughout the week. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, James Boyes and James Schneider. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Rowena Wiles. And our studio manager was Bill Luti. Next up on Section D, we'll be hitting fashion and furniture trade fairs in Berlin, London and Cologne. Tune in to Tom Morris as he'll tell you all about that. That's right after me, after the news. The Monocle Daily is later, 2200 hours. Midori House back at the same time live tomorrow, 1800 hours London time. But from all of us here today, I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
tells the story of a passion for motor racing, a legend forged over time by the pioneers of speed and great drivers. The Daytona Cosmograph, the watch made to break barriers, the watch dedicated to endurance, the watch that was born to race. Rolex.